Ladies and gentlemen, now hosting the RizzoCast, put your hands together for Steven Risotto!
What is going on, everybody, and welcome. My name is Steven Risotto. I cover the San Francisco Giants for SFA, and I'm the host of RizzoCast, a podcast that features current and former big league players, coaches, fans, media, and others who are regarded as some of the brightest minds around the game of baseball. We are coming to you live from the podcast studio inside the Golden Gate Express newsroom at San Francisco State University. And joining me to join today's guest, Sean Young. Sean is a friend of mine and editor, one of my colleagues at the Golden Gate Express, the student-run newspaper of San Francisco State University. Also a very big sports fan, big baseball fan, big journalism fan. That's a constant theme. But Sean, we interviewed Jeff Perlman today. Jeff is a New York Times best-selling author of 10 books. He's come on the podcast before. If you haven't read any of his books, if you don't listen to his podcast, if you don't read his Substack, you are missing out. But Sean, first of all, thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And it was a fun conversation. We are aspiring journalists, right? We are, we talk about, you know, Jeff Perlman's work a lot and writers similar to Jeff Perlman. What should the listeners know about this episode?
This episode covers a little bit of everything from beginnings of journalism careers and how to approach those to talking about several of Jeff's books. Football for a Buck, obviously about the USFL, a little bit about Showtime that got turned into Winning Time, the HBO series, Love Me, Hate Me, the greatest book about Barry Bonds ever. We covered a little bit of everything with Jeff.
Yeah, and one thing to note is that, like, Jeff is one of the premier storytellers in journalism today, and he's also one of the most transparent journalists out there. Like, he will tell you his process. He will be a help to the young writers, and I think that's one thing that we got out of him, too.
Absolutely, and I think we got more than enough details on some of his process for his upcoming book about the late Tupac Shakur.
Yeah, definitely. Tupac Shakur, we're looking forward to that book. We were looking forward to the Bo Jackson book. We were looking forward to the Winning Time. Hopefully everybody loves this episode just like we did. Enjoy it. Give us a review. Do all that fun stuff. But please enjoy the episode. And this is episode number 164 of RizzoCast. And let's get started. All right. We are back on RizzoCast. And we are very pleased to be joined by a very special guest. It is Jeff Perlman. He is the New York Times best-selling author. He's written a handful of books, 10, I believe, right? 10. And there's one on the way. We'll get to that in just a second. But this is Jeff's second time on this podcast. He was great the first time. And there's a lot that has happened to him since he's come on the last time. So, Jeff, we appreciate the time. Thanks for coming on.
Is it true you double the amount of money you're paying me for my second time, for my first time?
I have not made a dime off this podcast. One day, maybe, but we could definitely work something out. I'll have my people talk to your people. How about that?
Yeah. Well, considering I made $0.00 the first time, you can triple how much I made and be totally fine.
There you go. And I guess we could start. I mean, you just wrapped up a 9-hour drive to Sacramento, California. You're living in SoCal, so that's a 9-hour drive to Sacramento to interview a source for your Tupac book. In case people out there don't know, that's your next book, is a biography on Tupac. I want to ask, because Sean and I are both journalists, what is the value in making these in-person trips, and how does it kind of add to your reporting?
Well, there's more value if it works out. This one didn't totally work out, but I don't know. Sometimes you can knock on someone's door and just be really pleasantly surprised. Sometimes you call and you don't hear back, and you write a letter and you don't hear back, or maybe you can't find a phone number. You try snail mail, you don't hear back. And sometimes when people are faced with you in person, it sort of changes their mind, or maybe they feel a little pressure. They feel on the spot. I mean, the best example I can give, I have so many examples from my career, actually, of knocking on doors. For my book I did about the Shaq Kobe era Lakers, there was a former Laker named J.R. Ryder. And all I had was an address. I could not get him on the phone. And I showed up at his house in Arizona. I literally drove to his house, knocked on the door. And after basically kind of threatening me, agreed to talk and gave me 2 hours of awesomeness. So I don't know. I'm also a fan of it. I think there's a value in talking face to face with someone. That if you sit down with someone in person, you tend to get a lot more than you do if you're on the phone, because you can read the body language and you can kind of see the expressions they make. And I just think there's a value to it. Also, I like driving, so it doesn't bother me.
And you added, did you get a good podcast recommendation? Because I saw you put it out on Twitter. Did you get any good recommendations on what podcasts to listen to on the drive?
I did. I'm listening to The Wedding Scammer, which is a Ringer podcast, and I'm absorbed by it. In fact, I literally stopped listening to it to make this call and would jump back on afterwards. It's fantastic. So I did.
Yeah, well, hopefully you enjoy that. I'm going to have to put that on my list too. We'll get back to Tupac in just a second, but I want to talk about, you know, one of the reasons why kind of we thought to have you on was the big developments in sports journalism universe. And the big one obviously has been the, I guess, slow dismantling of Sports Illustrated. And that's a site that you proudly used to write for. And for those of us that listen and are devout fans of Two Writers Sling and Yang, you know, you've mentioned it a handful of times and, you know, kind of how sad you are that it's happening. And for a publication that was previously considered the mecca of storytelling in sports for decades and decades, what led to this downfall? And I guess, you know, we're a few weeks after the news that the Arena Group kind of laid off a lot of their writers. And how are you holding up now? Because I know it's difficult to see that former employer, I guess, not have good times.
Well, I mean, for me, I'm fine. It's, you know, I left a long time ago, but it's a huge bummer. I just think there are a lot of things. I think, first of all, so I left Sports Illustrated in 2003. And at the time, we were behaving as if the internet were just this nuisance. Like, truly, that in a way is the genesis of it all. You had places like ESPN taking on the internet, you know, full charge. And how can we use this? And what can we do with this? And how, you know, we're going to lure readers to our website by having fantasy sports. And we're going to have the, you know, Bill Simmons writing the sports guy. And we're going to really do something with it. And SI never did. Still to this day, the website is just kind of disappointing. And they never really did. They never knew how to work it. I feel like there certainly was a moment when SI or Time Warner, which is the SI company, had an opportunity to buy ESPN and didn't think it was a good investment. And instead sort of started working on, you know, we used to have a channel, CNN SI, and it was crap. You know, it wasn't very good. And even the website name for a long time was CNNSportsIllustrated.com. I mean, it's terrible. So it was just a lot of people who no longer work there who really mangled the adjustment to the internet. And the other thing is, honest to God, when I was at Sports Illustrated, the number one priority, obviously, it was, you know, the goal was to make money, et cetera. But the magazine itself, the number one priority was to just do kick-ass journalism. You know, we have to send a reporter for 20 days to so-and-so site. We're going to do it in the name of a story. We have to fly a reporter to Greenland because there's a cool story about the only golf course in Greenland. We're going to do it. And somewhere along the line, everywhere, not just SI, everywhere, it stopped being about the journalism first and foremost, and it became about profit first and foremost. And that's really deflating. Like, somewhere out there, you just need people to be a little less selfish and a little more recognizing of the value and importance of journalism in a free-flowing and functioning democracy. I think right now in America, we really lack that, and SI is a good indicator of that.
Yeah, without a doubt. And you know, we've kind of learned about the good days of Sports Illustrated through you know, writers like yourself, and you've told some good stories about your time there. And I want to see if you could highlight maybe one or two good, solid stories or moments that you have from your time at Sports Illustrated. I'm sure that's a loaded question, so pick from the buffet.
Oh man. I mean, first of all, I got there as a scrub. Like, I started there as a fact checker and the idea was I was hired from a newspaper in Tennessee. We're going to give you the opportunity to sort of show that you can write, but you're a fact checker. And when I got promoted to writer, they used to have, I mean, this is how much money these places had. They would have a Sports Illustrated around Christmas. They'd have the Sports Illustrated holiday party, which, by the way, was like enormous barroom, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. They'd fly in every writer for the magazine from across the country, fly them, put them up in hotels, et cetera. And you would have the state of the magazine meeting a couple of days before the party. And I remember the first time I was invited to this meeting. And it was like, honest to God, I always say, this is dating myself now. It's like, you know, Christian Laettner on the 92 Dream Team, where he's surrounded by Larry Bird and Michael Jordan and Chris Mullin and Ewing. And he knows he doesn't belong. And that's how I felt. All my heroes, all these writing bigwigs surrounding me. And I'm just like, holy crap, this is amazing. And like, when I started covering, so one of my first beats was Major League Baseball. And I would be the inside baseball columnist, which meant every week we have a meeting. We'd say, all right, let's do Sean Casey in Cincinnati. Then we'll do Gary Sheffield with the Dodgers. And then we'll do Mike Sweeney with the Royals. And it wouldn't even be, you call the travel department and you'd say, all right, I need to book a trip, Cincinnati, LA, Kansas City. Boop, boop, boop. They'd be like, okay, we're going to put you up in this hotel. Is that okay? Great. Rent a car? Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, great. It was just, everything was about the story. Everything was about the story. And when you worked for SI back in the day and you were coming, like if we were coming to do a Gary Sheffield story with the Dodgers, Sheffield would be thrilled. Like he'd want it. The Dodger PR staff would want it. Everything about getting featured in Sports Illustrated mattered in a huge, enormous way. And nowadays, and this is very old manny of me, I admit, sitting here at 51, like it's like the agents control everything. Most athletes have their own messaging platform via social media, so they don't really care anymore if someone's going to write, you know, 10,000 words for the New Yorker about them. It doesn't really matter anymore. So it was such a different era and such a glorious era to be a sports writer.
That's awesome. Yeah. With that, you know, it's really great to hear you talking about like your early history, specifically at Sports Illustrated, and especially as like an early journalist sort of in the beginning of your career. You know, there was a while ago in January, right around the same time as a lot of the SI news was coming out, you put out some advice for young journalists. And you were sort of saying how to make themselves indispensable by going out and doing as much writing as possible, going out and, you know, making a Substack, going ahead and starting a podcast, doing whatever they can to get their start in the industry and making themselves indispensable. And you got a little bit of pushback on that from Twitter and from other people in the industries. My question is more, how does the current media landscape need to change in order for our next generation of journalists, storytellers, authors, all these people that are out there and trying to get their start, how do we make sure that they thrive instead of just surviving?
It's hard. I mean, that's a loaded question. It's really hard. First of all, my advice wasn't bad. I don't care what ex people say. My advice was good. And I'll say it to you two guys as like young up and coming journalists, like you do have to make yourself indispensable. You do have to own every platform possible. It doesn't guarantee that you'll save a job or even get a job, but you have to show. I always say to, I teach at a school in Southern California as an adjunct at Chapman University. And I always tell my students, you need to show someone my age that you know something I don't. So you know what the next TikTok is, you know what the next whatever is. And you need to also show that you can work a million different platforms. And I wasn't these people who are like, oh, shut up, old man. It's like, I'm not saying this is going to land you a job, but it does put you in a much better position. And the days of just being a good writer, oh, I'm a really good writer. Well, that's not enough anymore. You have to be a master of all. So that's the first thing. I mean, the second thing is like, I just think somewhere along the line, there have to be some platforms or some very, very, very uber wealthy human beings who are more concerned with journalism than their 401k. And there have to be some investors who are willing to say, we just really need to cover X extremely well, and we will go to all lengths to do it. I just do. That's what we need right now. And there's some, I thought Jeff Bezos was a little more of that with the Washington Post. I thought the guy who owns the LA Times was going to be a little more of that. It's easy to say you care about journalism until like you realize you're losing money and things are failing and X and Y. Man, I can't lie to you. It's a really tough scene right now. And it sucks because being a journalist is the greatest gig in the world. But it's hard.
Yeah, I thought a lot of the advice was like pretty solid. Like, to be honest, me and Sean have talked about this and, you know, a lot of it was very solid. And we definitely think that you're one of the best at giving out advice. And there's a few days there, Jeff, where your Twitter account was suspended. Like, do you think that that was core? I'm going to start. Do you think that that was correlated together with the comments?
That's so funny. I don't, but I did think about that for a little bit. I don't, it's possible. I don't, you know, I'll tell you what really annoyed me about that. There's a website called The Defector, and it was a former Deadspin, bunch of Deadspin guys. Maybe you guys read it. And the editor, he's, you know, I don't know how old he is, 40, 35, was, you know, calling me out and bashing. He literally wrote a column about how my advice about be indispensable, you know, blah, blah, blah. You're an old man and you have no business giving this advice. I'm like, I look at this guy's resume and he's only ever worked at one place. He's never really written anything. He's never really recorded anything. He's never hosted a podcast. He never did a Substack. He's barely active on social media. And it's kind of like, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. Like, yeah, I'm older, but man, I have fought to stay relevant and I kind of get the fight. And I do think I understand this industry fairly well. I'm not saying I'm a genius or anything, but like there is something to be said for trying to maintain your relevancy and using every mechanism possible to do so. So I don't know. It annoyed me.
Yeah. And that's perfect because like Twitter, in a lot of ways, that's kind of how, like, I guess Sean and I discovered a lot of your work was through, I guess, you advertising your books or upcoming books on Twitter. And, you know, I guess for there to be like a gap, like when you were suspended, and I don't know if you've been suspended before, but probably not.
Never.
Yeah, but yeah, so never. I'd imagine that, like, you know, because, you know, as you know, Twitter is probably a solid place for you to promote your books and your work, and you're on it enough. But do you feel like in the event that, you know, let's knock on wood that your profile's fine, but if in the event that it's ever messed with again, do you feel like something will be missing in your life, in your career, like a tool, or do you think you'll be just fine without Twitter?
All right, first of all, I hate Twitter. I hate Twitter. I hate everything about it. I hate Elon Musk. I hate the negativity. I hate the bots. I hate everything about Twitter. However, I recognize that it's an amazing mechanism to communicate and to find people and to read. I mean, you guys found me on Twitter. Like, this is kind of the way of finding people. So I do think there's real value. There was a part of me when my account got frozen where I was like, I was saying to my wife, I was like, maybe this is good. Maybe this is it. This is it. This is it. I'm done. That's good. But then I just kept thinking about it. Like, you have 70,000 followers or whatever it is. You have books coming out. A lot of these people are people who seem to appreciate your work or at least, you know, follow it. It's quite a tool, you know? So I don't know, man. I mean, I was half of me was like, thank God, I'm never coming back. Praise Jesus. And the other half of me was like, I don't know. Like, I'm going to have a book out and I'm losing this major mouthpiece megaphone. I don't know. Hopefully it won't happen again, but I don't know what I'll do.
Yeah. It's like this Instagram Threads thing isn't working out too good.
Yeah. I mean, I'm on Threads and nobody pays attention to it. So, you know, yeah, I know.
Yeah. I used it for the first day when everybody thought the world was ending and then just never use it again. But hey, let's move on to Deion Sanders real quick. Great transition. Deion Sanders is one of the more polarizing subjects in sports at the moment. And, you know, whenever Sean and I listen to Two Writers, Sling and Yang, we always kind of debrief the next day. And there's a recent episode where the Denver Post columnist Sean Keeler mentioned that, and this was kind of surprising to me because I had known maybe there's some of this going on, but not as much as Sean, you know, brought up, is the alarming amount of media who are constantly praising and almost to some extent, like on their knees, worshiping Deion, you know, in their day-to-day coverage at the University of Colorado football. You know, in that sense, like, and you know, I've seen the video of, you know, the TV reporter with the hug and introducing her mom and all. Is objectivity and fairness still prevalent in sports journalism? And I know in this case you have plenty to say on Deion, but just what do you think about all of that and how that's kind of gone down?
So it's really interesting. I do a weekly, kind of weekly Substack, and I wrote last week about a guy named Steve McMichael, a former Chicago Bear, got inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And Steve McMichael has very late stage ALS. And all the coverage of it was, it's so great he's in. What a courageous story. Hooray, Steve McMichael. This is great. And I kept thinking, how is nobody mentioning the ties between ALS and football? The now very well-documented, well-studied ties between ALS and football, that football players are four times more likely than your non-football playing person to get ALS. And the longer you are exposed to football, the more likely you are to get AOS. And here's a guy who played 15 years in the NFL. Not a mention, like nobody, not a mention until a column by Rick Kellender in Chicago Sometimes last week. And I just felt like something is broken here. When I was at SI, there's no way you would let that go. You would have to address it. You would have to broach it. Your editors would say so. And the same, and I think people are afraid of the NFL. I do. And the same thing with Deion Sanders. Like, this guy has a long history, almost Donald Trumpian, of sort of being full of shit. You know, going back to a high school he started in Texas that went belly up. Like, there's a lot of con man in that guy. And people are so afraid, so intimidated, the power he's accumulated. People are afraid of being called out on social media. People are afraid of being blocked. People are afraid of being ignored. People are afraid of the, you know, getting doxxed on Twitter by a million Colorado fans who suddenly, because of Deion Sanders' directives, call you out, and they're all coming after you. It's just become a totally different landscape. And it takes a lot more in 2024 to be a courageous and forthright journalist than it did even a decade ago. And I think you see that with him.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's one thing I was always curious about. It's just like when sports figures become more than just like a sports person, they become these sort of icons and they get this sort of worship that and praise that isn't necessarily gratified to them by who they are as a person, but by their accomplishments in sports. And so I guess what I would ask is, how do you sort of navigate those complexities of writing about these different icons, and sort of how, you know, their successes and struggles as people are sort of compared to how their public image as just an athlete is seen?
Well, I mean, a lot of it is you have to decide as a writer and as a member of the media, what you want to be. I mean, a perfect example, I'm working on this book about Tupac. I've interviewed well over 500 people by now. And what I found in the coverage of him and his life, and especially after he died, is a very iconic, oftentimes sort of holy, Christ-like portrayal. And it would be easy for me to write that book. Tupac Shakur represented this and that and everything that's good and blah, 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 and the future of hip hop. But that's not who people are. That's just not who people are. People are complicated and nuanced. The good news is, I think if you want to do journalism, do journalism the right way and do reporting the right way, I think it stands out more than ever. Like you mentioned Sean Keeler in my podcast. Sean is one of the few guys in the Colorado market willing to call out Deion Sanders. And yeah, maybe that'll get him some hate on Twitter, but it gets him a lot of respect in the actual business, in the industry. So to me, I'm not really afraid of getting, you know, a million Tupac fans mad at me and how dare you do that, because I want to feel good about myself as a journalist. And I don't care about legacy, but I kind of want my work to stand the test of time. And if you're always giving someone a blowjob, your work isn't going to stand the test of time. You're going to be dismissed and ultimately forgotten. I don't want that.
Yeah. And one of the things that, and this is kind of a different subject, but one of the things that you've discussed is that relationship between the media and the athlete, like multiple times. And you've described it as, you know, kind of one-sided. Like the example that is often brought up is the Buster Olney story about where Buster, I guess, had a cast on his hand and nobody asked about it. Whereas Buster, you know, covering the Yankees, he's got to know whether, you know, El Duque's finger is okay after a start. And every day, got to check in on El Duque's finger and Jorge Posada's hamstring. And all this stuff adds up. And it's like almost not the same, you know, reciprocal. It's not the same. It's pretty one-sided. Why do you think that is? Do athletes just like legitimately not care about writers? And do you see that, I guess, changing?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, they shouldn't care about writers. Like, I never cared if a baseball player, I mean, maybe when I was young and kind of dumb and impressionable, but why do I care if Ken Griffey knows about my life? Like, that's not, his job isn't to, my job is to know about Ken Griffey's life. Ken Griffey's life, his job isn't to know about my life. So I don't think when Buster told me that story years and years ago, he wasn't complaining about the dynamic. It just is what it is. It's a reality. We are there to cover them. They are not here to cover us. What is interesting is, I think in the modern era of media, with the Skip Bayless and the Stephen A. Smith, that sort of, you know, loud, brash, TV first, blah, blah, blah. A lot of people in media, Bill Simmons, et cetera, want to be famous and they want to be known and they want people asking about them. Personally, I don't care if anyone knows about me. Like I didn't enter this profession to be famous. I entered it because I really enjoy reporting and asking questions. So I don't think the dynamic is ever going to change where all of a sudden athletes care about reporters. But I do think there's a lane, if reporters want it, where they can become famous in that sort of skip Stephen A way, if that's what they want. But it feels like empty calories to me.
Absolutely. With that, I sort of want to pivot a little bit and work back to the beginnings of your career. So obviously you talked a little bit about you being a young journalist just then, but obviously you graduated from the University of Delaware, go the Fighting Blue Hens, if I'm not mistaken.
Very nice. Yeah.
Thank you. And you started your career after you graduated at the Tennessean as a food and fashion writer. And I feel like that's sort of interesting to know because obviously RizzoCast is a podcast that likes to talk about journalism and sports, but obviously food and fashion is 180 degrees away from that. Are there any skills that you sort of picked up while working there though at the Tennessean during your first sort of journalism start that you still use in your career?
Oh, I mean, that was the most important place I've ever worked. I was at the Tennessean for 2.5 years. I arrived as a very, very cocky little know-it-all asshole who thought he had every answer to every question, who didn't want to listen to people who gave advice. I didn't know how to report. I, you know, was sloppy. I made so many mistakes. I was so full of myself. One thing you don't know when you're young and you learn later on, like to a young reporter, oftentimes it's competition and you're scratching and clawing and you see your peers as competition. And as you get older, you realize that those people you viewed as competitors, they just wanted to get home and like hang out with their kids and have dinner and see their spouses and take vacations. Like they love journalism, but it wasn't like a competition to them. And I didn't see it at that point. And the greatest lesson of my career is I was working in the features department at the Tennessean. I made one mistake after another mistake after another mistake after another mistake. I mean, spelling, facts, sloppiness, arrogance, everything you could do. And my editor called me into her office. Her name was Catherine Mayhew. She called me into her office, told me I was screwing up, that I was on the verge of not keeping this job, and she was going to put me on the cops beat, the late night police beat. And your job is to sit here with the scanner, listen for crimes. If there's something worth pursuing, pursue it. You don't have to dazzle us with your writing. Who, what, where, when, how, and why. Get it right. Spell the names right, get the ages right, get the facts right. And let's see if you can develop those skills. And that is, if there's a moment in my career that changed everything, that was it.
Awesome. I definitely understand that. I have a couple of friends who are getting started in the industry, same exact thing, police beat, late night, turn on the radio and just listen, get the who, what, when, where, why, and get all that right. And so obviously you took those skills and you moved forward in your career, obviously moved on to Sports Illustrated. And then I was looking under your website and under your page for your first book, The Bad Guys Won, about the 86 Mets, you commented that you never really thought too much about becoming an author, but watching one of your fellow colleagues, John Wertheim at Sports Illustrated, sort of go through the process of writing his own book, you thought that you would give making a book a try. Looking back to your first book, what advice would your current self give yourself, your past self?
Yeah, do a better job. I mean, it's funny because that book, The Bad Guys Won, is my best-selling book by far. It's, you know, people, I'm not saying it's a great book, but I get people all the time, oh man, The Bad Guys Won, love that book, one of my favorite baseball books. Again, I'm not saying it's worthy of that praise, but I do, of all the books I've written, that's the one I get the most. And I look back at it, and there are parts of it I think are okay, but I see a lot of warts. I see a lot of like holes in the reporting. It's the fewest number of people I've interviewed for a book. If I were doing that book again, I would interview 5 times the amount of people I interviewed for it. As I've gotten older in this business, I just really believe in the dig and report and report and report and report. There are always going to be better writers. They're better writers than me. They're better writers than you guys. They're always going to be better writers, but you can control how much you report. And my guiding, like them, my guiding principle, which I really picked up at SI, is like, it's not just, he wasn't just drinking a soda. He was like Tupac. Tupac didn't just smoke cigarettes. He smoked Newports, you know, and he would smoke them down to the stub and then he'd flick them a certain way. Like those little gritty details paint the pictures that make great stories. And I would say when I was working on that book, I was on my way to learning that, but I wasn't quite there yet.
We're going to take a break on RizzoCast, but first, here's a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, RizzoCast listeners, how are you enjoying the show so far? If you are enjoying the content and want more RizzoCast, please make sure to subscribe and leave a review on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. We're also on social media, so follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at RizzoCast. Now let's get back to the show.
That's really good stuff. And did Lenny Dykstra ever receive the check that you wrote out to him?
He never. Lenny Dykstra just had a stroke the other day, which is
what?
Kind of crazy.
I didn't see that.
I have a Lenny Dykstra. You want to hear the craziest Lenny Dykstra story of all time?
Let's hear it.
Okay, Lenny Dykstra is insane. And a couple years ago on Twitter, he was mad at me for something, and he put on social media, let's rate Jeff Perlman's wife's hotness. And he posted a picture of my wife. Now, my wife is a social worker who donated a kidney to a stranger. Like, she is as unworthy of any of this as of anybody you could imagine. She's just a good, good person. So he puts this out on Twitter, and I DM'd him and I was like, listen, I get if you're mad at me or you don't like the book, fair game. But my wife, you know, she just donated a kidney a couple months ago. You're really going to have her on there. And he wrote me back and he was like, hey, dude, I just wanted to see if you'd stand up for her. Bravo for you. I'm taking it down. Okay. He takes the tweet down. I thought it would be funny to hire him on Cameo because my wife has a good sense of humor and do a Cameo and be like, hey, Catherine, blah, blah, blah. Sorry about that. I give you an E. You know, simple like that. I give you an E. So he does it. He does a Cameo shirtless. He does it. And he does this Cameo. And it's super weird. And I DM'd him. This all happened within like a 3-day span. I DM'd him to thank him for doing the Cameo and told him like no hard feelings about the whole thing on Twitter. And he had no idea what I was talking about. Like he literally had no idea. So I don't even think he controls his own Twitter feed, but he didn't know what the hell I was talking about. It was the weirdest thing ever.
That's insane. Well, I mean, I didn't know about the stroke news. We hope Lenny's okay. I think.
Of course. I'm not rooting for Lenny Dykstra to die. No, of course not.
Sean brought up, I'm glad that Sean brought up the Bad Guys one because that was amazing. And since you were last on the podcast, your Bo Jackson book was released and Winning Time, the excellent HBO show based on your book about the Lakers, ended up getting canceled, sadly, after 2 seasons. Those are two pretty big developments that have happened to you over the past few years. And I guess looking back on both of them, what are your key takeaways on how those last few years have gone for you with the Bo book and then the show?
I mean, it's funny because nobody ever wants to hear you whine about only having 2 seasons of an HBO show. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't go over well. Someone's like, I lost my job or blah, blah, blah. So-and-so died. Nobody wants to hear, man, I have a tough 2. I only got 2 seasons of an HBO show. It's really tough. So like, it sucked. It was disappointing, but nobody wants to hear you complain. And it was an amazing, amazing, amazing experience, like truly amazing experience for me. And the Bo Jackson book was great, but also like ended with a really weird experience, which is, the book came out. I was scheduled to do a 4 book event in Alabama, which I did. They were all at independent bookstores. And apparently Bo Jackson, not a rep, Bo Jackson himself, called all the bookstores and asked them not to allow me to speak. And they all did allow me to speak, but he was apparently not pleased with the book and took time out of what you'd think would be a relatively busy life to call these independent mom and pop bookstores and ask them not to let me talk. Very weird. Never had
that. You think he read it?
I think his wife read it. Cause I know there was a part I was told there was that his wife was really upset, which I guess I understand. because when he was in college, he was engaged to her and another woman kind of at the same time. And I think she probably wasn't pleased by that detail. But I don't know if he read it or not. I have no idea.
Yeah, interesting. And now I guess it's on the Tupac. And again, you know, we're big followers on Twitter. And yesterday you tweeted that a well-known hip-hop journalist said that, you know, you have no reason writing this Tupac book. And I guess I want to know what makes this upcoming biography different from the ones that I guess have already been released. And why do you, Jeff Perlman, the well-known sports writer, kind of feel like you're the right one to write it?
It's kind of funny. You know, Beyonce has the number one song on the country charts right now. And I was thinking like, all right, there you go, Beyonce. Now I feel that. Like, I feel like, first of all, why not me? You know, like, why not me? First of all, Tupac's music way transcends race, class, ethnicity. Like, you know, he's an iconic American figure, like, period. World figure, period. Second of all, I don't think there's been a great Tupac biography. There have been a ton of books written. A lot of them are, like, kind of, I'm not dogging any authors, but a lot of it is, like, kind of cheesy, like, who killed Tupac, Tupac versus Biggie, blah, 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 blah. There's a great, great Tupac encyclopedia that's out, but I don't think there's been a great definitive biography. And it's been fascinating for me. It's so different than doing sports. The characters are amazing. The people I've met are riveting. The places I've traveled. I've always, it's funny because the thing that he said to me about, you know, white, you know, whatever. Like, I actually feel like every white person should have the experience I'm having on researching this, because you see things in this country that you just usually would not be exposed to. I really mean that. Like, just the trauma of growing up black in this country, the history of the Black Panthers, which has been so misconstrued by mainstream America, going into public housing and seeing what it is to grow up in public housing. I mean, most of the guys Tupac grew up with, including Tupac, in both Baltimore and Marin City, just kind of assumed they wouldn't live past 25. They call 20 the hump. If you made it over the hump, if you made it past 20, it's the impact of crack on the inner cities in America. I mean, I remember, like, growing up, and you'd make fun of someone and call them a crackhead. I will never derisively refer to anyone as a crackhead ever again, because that shit, I mean, that overwhelmed communities in ways that, like, I understood but didn't fully understand. So, like, coming off the Bo Jackson book, which I really did enjoy, I feel like I've jumped into the deep end of a really, really, really ocean deep pool, and I'm just trying to figure it all out, and I'm riveted times a thousand. It's not even about the music. I love Tupac's music, but it's so much more than just his music. It's this life and this journey that is just blowing my mind.
I think that's so important for you to address, that, you know, you're going in there and you're doing the work to actually understand and research, you know, what it is, not necessarily just about Tupac, but just about, you know, African-Americans in the Black community growing up in that sort of era of crack cocaine and the war on drugs and sort of all those influences that influenced to where Tupac sort of came to where he is. And so you're doing all these interviews with people who are still around and you're gathering all this information. You know, I recently saw one of your TikToks where you said you give yourself about like 6 months or so to write a book once you're done gathering all this information. And I know you still probably have a bunch more to do, but once you get to that writing process, what does that average day look for like for you when you're in that process? Do you set any like certain goals for yourself in terms of your writing, or do you sort of just write throughout that 6 months and see what you end up with by the end of it?
First, I want to say you guys are very good at this. These are all like exceptionally good. I really mean that, like really, really good. Second of all, one thing I just want to address real quick off of the last thing I said is I think one thing that's important to do, at least has been important for me to do, especially with this book, is to acknowledge that I'm coming from an outsider's position. Like for example, when I've been interviewing former crack dealers in Marin City, and I've interviewed a ton, I always say, and I know it's obvious, but I always make it clear, like, I'll be like, look, I'm a white guy from upstate New York. I grew up with a dad who was a CPA and a mom who was a probation officer. This is not my universe. So please speak to me like someone who's not from this world, because I'm not, but I'm incredibly curious about it. So I just think, like, I'm owning it. Like, I'm not pretending I'm some expert in this universe that I'm not. And I'm not pretending I'm from this universe where I'm not. And I think that's been really kind of refreshing for me and has been a pretty good approach. Just wanted to say that. As for writing, it's a nightmare. I mean, it's the worst part of it. Like, my friend John Wertheim, who we mentioned earlier, when I was first doing the Bad Guys One, he said, you got to think of a book. Every chapter is like a long magazine feature. And that way it makes it manageable. Instead of thinking, wow, I have 160,000 words to write. All right, I have this 10,000 word magazine piece. And the other thing is every day you set a goal that you try to stay consistent on. So when I'm writing, I got to hit 1,000 words today. Every day I have to hit 1,000 words. And it may not be the best 1,000 words. You may have to go back later and destroy it or change it. But you got to get 1,000 words on the page or on the screen. So that's kind of how I do it. And it's a lot of like, okay, I'm blocking social media for the next 5 hours. I print everything out. I'm super old in that way. I like having stuff in front of me. I like having stuff underlined. I like having stuff highlighted. I like digging through paper. I like the feel of it all. It drives my wife crazy. She's like, can't you just stop printing everything out? And I'm like, not yet. Maybe next book. But that's kind of what I do. And every day, it's just sit down and you write. And if I was a pot smoker or a drinker, I'd probably be all over it because this shit drives you crazy. Instead, I just like take a break and play like Xbox with my kid.
That's awesome. I recently, my community college professor is writing a book and they just finished it. And they still do that same sort of process where they print out everything, hard copy, underline all the sort of grammatical marks, everything. So yeah. I'm glad to hear that there's other people out there that do that as well. Sort of pivoting, throughout your career, you know, you've dealt with a variety of different subjects in the sports world, and some of them have been more distrustful with the media and journalists than others. As you're doing your interviews for this Tupac book, have you noticed a shift of people? How do they view your work as a journalist? Do people feel more reserved or guarded? Obviously, there's a lot, you know, in the world about the fake news, the fake media, all that. Do you feel that right now, or what's the current status?
So that's interesting. I think it depends on who you're covering. The hip hop universe tends to be a fairly liberal world. I also think having Winning Time in my back pocket has definitely helped my legitimacy. This is the first time I've written a book on a different medium than sports, and I use that all the time. You know, I'll always introduce myself and say, hey, my name is Jeff Perlman. I'm a longtime journalist, longtime author. I was also a producer on Winning Time. It's based on my book. That helps a lot. I think the thing that has been complicated with this book is a lot of people just don't know me. I haven't written about hip hop. I'm not a guy who used to write for Rolling Stone or Spin or Vibe. That's been hard, but I don't think the whole fake news thing has impacted me here. So that's been actually pretty good.
And I guess a few more here before we wrap up. But during the book reporting process, you always show off the research that you conduct. You're very transparent about, you know, the process of writing a book on Twitter. And in the case of this Tupac book, that means interviewing and reading every other Tupac book that you could find in any other magazine story or newspaper article. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know you're big on newspapers.com. I've always wondered, when you're finished with this and the Tupac book comes out and everything, what happens to that collection of all the, like, the 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 Tupac books that you have? Do you keep it? Where does that go? Do you resell it? What happens with all that research that you've accumulated?
That's a funny question. So most of it, all right, so all the things I print out, I recycle. There are certain journalists I know who keep all their stuff and 40 years later they can pull out. I'm not that guy. Like, my wife would kill me if I had 10 books worth of research in the attic. I mean, she would divorce me with good reason. So I recycle all the printed material, the interviews. The books, if I know someone who's interested or might be interested in a certain book or some of the books, I'll give them to them. Otherwise, I just donate them either to, you know, we have a local Goodwill or whatever, Salvation Army. I just donate them and, you know, maybe someone enjoys them. That's it. Not so exciting.
Man, I was hoping you would keep that sort of collection forever and ever. That being said, you know, we both go to San Francisco State. San Francisco, obviously, home of the Giants. One of your books, Love Me, Hate Me, Barry Bonds and the Making of the Antihero. You know, I know me and Stephen both grew up as San Francisco Giants fans. But Barry Bonds is one of those very contradictory and controversial sports figures for people out there. My question is, do you think there will ever be another sports figure as controversial as Bonds? And possibly, is there anyone currently right now do you think is sort of the controversial figurehead for the world of sports?
I mean, I'm always reluctant to say, like, there'll never be a blank, you know, because there's always somebody else who comes along. The thing about Bonds that made him so unique, besides the fact that he was really talented and really juiced, is he was just such a magnificent asshole of a human being. And the way he treated people, like, just cruelly, not just mean, he wasn't just mean, he was legitimately cruel and spiteful and went out of his way to make people's lives more difficult. Like, that's unique. You don't find that many guys who are that big of a star with that level of meanness. I really mean that. I've covered jerks. I've covered ordinary guys. I've written about people who aren't my cup of tea. But he really enjoyed, took pleasure out of making your life harder. He almost seemed fascinated by the human dynamics of his greatness as opposed to your uselessness, you know? And I always, I recently had on my podcast a couple months ago now, Jeff Bradley, a former baseball writer. He told me something that stuck with me. He said he was doing Bonds one time. He was writing about Bonds and he said, he asked Barry Bonds a key to whatever is hitting. And Bonds said, it's called talent. I have it and you don't. And I was thinking, number one, like, what an asshole thing to say to someone. Like, what a purely asshole thing to say. Number two, you cheated. Like, you actually cheated. So, like, your whole claim of talent, well, you just undercut that by cheating to do it. And number three, like, you're just lucky that somehow in this universe, taking a wood stick and hitting a round object thrown at you is deemed valuable. Like, that's it. It's just blind luck. This guy, Jeff Bradley, was a hell of a writer. I can make a very strong argument that his talent is greater than your talent. But the arrogance to say that to someone, it just blows my mind. So will there be other Bonds out there? I mean, there'll be ball players who are just as good, and there'll be people who are just as jerky. But you might not get the marriage of jerkiness and talent and cheating in one package.
You know, I think you've summarized it great by calling him a magnificent asshole. I think that completely summarized it. Out of the 10 books you've written so far, you know, you've covered a variety of different subjects. Which one of those books has been the most rewarding for you in terms of just like interviewing, journal reporting, and just basic journalism?
I think the USFL book, Football for a Buck, is the one that I go back to the most. Number one, because my agent literally said to me, nobody wants a USFL book. Number two, because I made the least amount of money for it. Number three, it was just an absolute labor of love. And it mattered to me, like, I'm sure you guys, when that book came out, you didn't know what the USFL was, or if you did, it was in a vague sense, and maybe you still barely do. But I like the idea that I took something kind of obscure, wrote a book about it, educated people about something, it proved my agent wrong by making the New York Times list, and I just really, the number of football players, former USFL players, who felt good about being remembered again, like, that really warmed my heart. So that book was very, 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 very meaningful for me. And in a lot of ways, I think Tupac is replicating that feeling for me, where it just feels like a labor of love. And it's really hard. And it's really daunting. But there's a lot of love put into this book. And, you know, that's when you're at your best as a writer, I think it's when you love the subject and people love that you're writing about it.
There's a few years ago where I won a contest that you did on Twitter where you sent me the USFL book if I sent my address to you first. So I got the audiobook of that you had a few lying around. So appreciate that. Right before we wrap up, a few more things. Yeah. So Sean mentioned we go to San Francisco State University. We are editors on the newspaper. And there's, you know, this week's been weird. There's been a faculty strike that's been one of the largest faculty strikes in the United States history in terms of colleges. And it just got resolved. There's a vote yes on the tentative agreement. And this week, more than any other week that I've ever been associated with a publication, and this goes back to high school, community college, we have been constantly getting emails from sources, A, asking for the questions ahead of time, and B, when it's finished, can I change my quote? And we think that this is, you know, a very bad precedent to set in some regards. So I just got to ask, what is your philosophy on both of these issues? The questions before the interview and the annoying messages asking if people could change their quotes, because it's like really grinding our gears and it seems like it just doesn't stop coming.
Yeah. Number one, the answer is, you can either say, I'm sorry, journalistically, I can't do that. Or you can give some really vague, lame, well, I really just want to ask you about blah, 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 blah. You still have that happen when you've been doing this a long time. And what I usually tell people is like some variation of, you know, good interviews are conversations. So I don't really have questions to ask you. I just have some points in my head that I want to touch on. It'd be easier to do in person. And B, the answer is no. Like, no. I mean, every now and then, if there's some really good reason someone needs to change a quote, maybe. But if someone's like, let's say you get a quote from a professor and the professor's like, fuck this university, all these people can go to hell, fuck them all. And they write back and they're like, I don't know if I really want that out there. Generally, I'm like, sorry about that. But, you know, we already went to print or whatever, you know, like kind of the laws of journalism, you know. I mean, it does, but I will say, you do have to also have a sense of empathy. And if someone's like, look, on second thought, blah, 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 I just had my kid and I can't lose my job. Is there any way you could blank or blank? It is a case by case situation. Like, we're not in the business of ruining people. No.
Absolutely. No.
Most of the time.
Yeah, most of the time. Right.
Yeah. Just a couple of questions left for you. You know, this is one of the things we talk about often is, you know, we'll go over and we'll debrief episodes of your podcast, Tube Writer Slinking Yang. And we noticed in December that you did put up a special episode. And first off, before we get into this question, we would like to offer your condolences or our condolences to your father, Stanley. You know, how did you decide to record an episode of your podcast with your father, and where did you sort of find the emotional strength to record the episode?
Yeah. So, my dad died in December, December 20th. And, he was 81. He, easily my closest friend. And, it sucks. Like, it sucks. It really sucks. I miss talking to him every day. It sucks. And he lives in Florida. My parents live in Florida. I live in California. And I went there when I could tell it was going to be somewhere near the end. And I spent about 3 weeks in Florida. And I saw my dad getting worse every day. And I told him I wanted to. My dad had written a book and he used to write columns. He's just a really good writer. And I told him I wanted to record an episode of the podcast. And he was open to it. And I saw him slipping. And every day I was like, Dad, I'm going to do it today. And finally, we did it. I've listened to it a million times. It's definitely the most I've listened to any of my old episodes. It's hard to listen to. He's hiccuping throughout because he was sick. I just really needed something to hold on to. No, that's why I did it. I just wanted something to hold on to. Sometimes I feel a little haunted by it. It sucks, man. The advice I can give you guys, if your parents are still alive, is don't. It's easy to take it for granted, but you know, once they're gone, they're gone. Once people are gone, they're gone. And it hurts a lot. It hurts a lot. And just really try to appreciate, I know it's a cliche, but really try to appreciate the people you have around you while you have them there, because the losses like this really, they just gut you. So.
Absolutely. And thank you for sharing that. I know it probably was a bit difficult to try to go through that.
That's a good question. It's a fair, totally fair question. It's hard. It's hard.
To sort of pivot and end on a little bit of a happier note, you know, one of your TikToks recently, I love watching you on TikTok. You know, you called yourself a self-proclaimed coffee shop writer. So I guess my question is, what is your coffee order, or what is the best cafe you've ever been to?
Oh, man. There's a place in my hometown of Mayopac, New York, called the Freight House Cafe that I love. It has this big patio and very, like, feels like home. It's really good. And then there's a place in Dana Point, California, named J.C. Beans. Also big ups on J.C. Beans. Anywhere where there are a lot of books, comfortable chairs. But my order is very boring. I go to Starbucks, train the iced coffee, one shot of mocha, and some kind of very, like, you know, bougie oat or almond milk. And every now and then I'll treat myself to a mocha. But as you get older, the calories add up a little bit. So I love coffee shops. I love the illusion of social interaction. That you're there and you're alone, but you're not really alone. You can talk to the barista. And maybe the barista is some 19-year-old kid who just wants nothing to do with grandpa writing his book. But it makes you feel good to have someone to talk to.
Awesome. Well, Jeff, we were going to ask what your biggest confrontation is, but John Rocker is sitting right beside us, so we don't want to go too deep into that. But Jeff, we really appreciate you coming on, and this was definitely a blast, and I'm glad that we could make some time for this.
Wait, I want to tell you guys, and I mean this sincerely. That podcast, I was thinking the other day, I've been doing this for 7 years. I'm on my 7th year doing that podcast. I've never made a dime off of it. I've done it every week for 7 years. I have not missed a week. And the fact that you guys listen to it and enjoy it, it's such a payoff for me. So I really, really, truly appreciate that. And thank you for having me on. It's very kind of you.
Absolutely. We love the podcast. It's Sean and I, it's one of our favorites for sure. And anybody that wants to go ahead, Jeff is still on Twitter for now. He's on Twitter at Jeff Perlman. Go check him out. That new book is dropping pretty soon, next year, I believe. Is that right?
Next year. Yeah, at some point.
And then, of course, his awesome Substack, Jeff Perlman's Journalism Yang Yang. And then we mentioned Two Writers Slinging Yang throughout this. Go subscribe on the vehicle of your choice, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you find your podcasts. Really good stuff there. And then, of course, follow this podcast on it's RizzoCast at RizzoCast on Twitter and Instagram, and also on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, also the vehicle of your choice. I'm going to start using that, the vehicle of your choice. I think it's catchy. thank you, everybody, for listening, and have a great day.